entertained. I had no good understanding of what the crowd, who the crowd will be. We seem a very diverse audience here. But still, I mean, please feel free to chip in any time. We have no like set program of things we have to cover. Chip in any time. Let's get the conversation started. Comment. Just if you think something is cool and nice, I mean, say so. Yeah? If you think it sucks, say so. But I'll ask you to justify it. Yeah. So here's the plan. I intend to talk about like some basic ideas of probability and statistics, and I just take like the typical sequence of clinical studies that you go through for drug development. I just take this as an excuse to talk about things one by one. Yeah. So I prepared everything assuming most of you might not know probability calculus or statistics, right? I assume you all have a vague notion of probabilities. Like if I tell you, if I get out of here before 12, I'll go to the coffee shop, and if I go to the coffee shop with probability 50%, I'll get a cafe latte. With probability 50%, I'll get a cappuccino. Say our chance of getting out here before 12 is, Karen, what is it? So she told me we usually end, like we should wrap up by 12. So say my chance of being out here by 12 is 50%. So if I have a 50% chance of getting out here by 12, and if I get out, I have a 50% chance of getting a cafe latte or a cappuccino, what's my chance of drinking a cafe latte today? You multiply it, right? You multiply like a half is the probability of getting out here. And if I get out here, a half is the probability of getting my cafe latte. And you multiply them, right? It's a half times a half, yeah? So I assume that you know notions like this. So if things are equally likely, if there's 10 ways of doing something, the probability of seeing one of the 10 outcomes is 1 over 10. Things like that, I assume you're comfortable with. But by all means, scream and tell me. It's perfectly fair to just ask me to try to say something in different words, because there's kind of a problem. If something is unclear, it's not clear how to ask a pointed question, right? So feel free to just ask me to repeat something. I'll try, or if I can't, I'll ask if someone else in the audience can say it in different words, yeah? On that handout, that handout is just so that you have like something to hold on to and you see the structure. I've prepared like a list of 7 questions that I want us to chat about. And nothing happens if you don't get through all 7, so feel free to chip in any time. Actually, the more you tell me, the better, because then I start to get the feel of what you understand or what not, or whether we are on the same wavelength, yeah? So let's start with the whole idea of drug development. I'll tell it in the context of cancer, simply because I spent the last 10 years at, many of you might know, MD Anderson Cancer Center, big cancer hospital in Houston. They have a big biostatistics department there, and I was there for 10 years. It's quite interesting, like as a statistician in a big research hospital, you're something like you're the probability police, yeah? No, it's true. Like, are there any of the parents or clinicians or anyone aiming to go to medical school? Okay, you have to watch them, yeah. Because like medical doctors, I mean, they're smart people. They have gone through intensive training and everything, but they don't have that much training in math and probability and statistics because that's us, yeah. And so sometimes they do make intuitive mistakes. We'll talk about some, yeah? And when they carry out experiments in a research hospital, those are experiments with human subjects, right? It's clinical studies. We all understand that you have to allow for mistakes, you have to allow for errors. Like, you cannot immediately use the best treatment because you don't know what's the best treatment, right? You have to find out slowly. So we all understand to find out what's the best treatment to give to everyone. You have to compromise somewhere, yeah? So that there has to be, you have to be able to accept that initially you assign some patients to perhaps something that's not perfect, yeah? But you don't. You only want to do it to the extent that you really have to. You only want to do it if you have a good chance of learning something. One good picture, one good metaphor is in all these exercises, it's like a rainbow, and we hope at the end of the rainbow is a big pot of gold. Yeah, like you go through a lot of studies, you spend a lot of effort, a lot of money, a lot of people have to, a lot of patients have to volunteer to be on these studies. With little prospect of reward or help in the beginning, yeah. Only at the very, very end, if in the end we find a silver bullet, something that really works, then it could potentially help many patients down the road. So the whole idea is like a rainbow, and at the end there's like the big pot of gold, and that's what we are after, yeah. And unfortunately, it's a long rainbow. Good morning. Karen, what did you put in the abstract or in the title? This is about statistics in clinical trials that doesn't usually attract crowds, yeah? Must be the free coffee out there. Especially in cancer, some of the things we do are still very, it's almost like in the medieval ages, yeah? Like there's three things we can do about cancer: poison, cut, and burn. Chemotherapy, surgery, and radiation. Yeah, it's sad because it's not only one disease; it's many diseases. Yeah, it's important. It affects many people's lives. When it comes to effective treatment, we are still kind of a little bit in the dark. Yeah. Poison, cut, and burn, they probably did it like in the medieval ages, yeah? Perhaps a little bit more brutal, but the basic ideas are not so different. So poison is chemotherapy, which is still a very common treatment for many cancers. The whole idea is you deliberately give poison to the patients. The intention, of course, is when you dose it right, when you give the right kind of poison, hopefully you kill the tumor. Hopefully you kill the cancer. Not the patient, yeah. Although it's very like if you have family or friends who have gone through that, when it's very intense because you're trying to walk a tight line between killing the tumor and harming the patient unnecessarily, yeah. When you work with new chemotherapy agents, the first question is how much can the patients tolerate safely. You understand that you have to accept some probability of toxicity. You have to accept some chance of adverse side effects. Adverse side effects is the euphemism for, in the extreme case, it could be death. Yeah, people don't like to say that. You say like serious adverse events, but it's very serious. It certainly is serious for the patients who go through it. But you have to accept that you have to accept some risk of adverse events. Otherwise, there couldn't be a cure. Unless you give something potent, you cannot possibly hope to kill the tumor, right? So with all that in mind, here's the notion. When you investigate a new chemotherapy agent, you want to give as much of it as you can safely do without losing your patient, yeah? You accept that there is some chance of toxicity. It's not always death. It could also just be like some other severe toxicities. Yeah. What you want to do is you want to slowly find your way up the doses until you hit a dose where there is some chance of toxicity, but it's still a reasonable trade-off. And a lot of that is a judgment call. One commonly accepted rule, and that's considered reasonable, is to accept something like 30% toxicity. So if you give poison and there's a 1 in 3 chance of serious adverse events, it's also in that context it's called dose-limiting toxicity. That's accepted, yeah? So here comes now the formal question for us in math, yeah? There's this chemotherapy agent, essentially poison, yeah? How much of it can we give to the patients so that we risk something like a 3 out of 10 chance of toxicity, and not much more and not much less. We don't want to do much less. It's not that we want to harm the patients, but if there's no toxicity, then you won't hit the tumor either, right? So the target is really to get up to something like 30%. There was a handout going around. Did everyone get one? Otherwise, I have some extras here. Why don't we send it around? And thank you, Karen. There was one here. Thank you. So now we're going to talk a little bit about something more mathy. Yeah? Don't expect rocket science. The entire discussion today, it's just basic, good math. It's nothing super complicated. Yeah. And the first thing we are going to talk about is something that is still done a lot, like many trials are carried out that way. I'm going to ask you then how you feel about it, what you think about it. Yeah. Feel free to be critical, because it's not particularly smart what I suggest you now. Yeah. It's not my suggestion. This is what is still done a lot. Yeah. And keep in mind that these are people, these are patients. do we have one more copy here in front? Karen? Two. So how should we do that? I'll first show you like the picture of what you have in mind, and then I'll give you the algorithm of how we go. Karen, one more here. Thank you. So here's what we have in mind. Can you see my faint blue? What we have in mind is here is dose. And let's just generically label the dose with J. What you often have is for practical reasons, like what the pharmacy can do. Dose is usually not continuous, but there's a discrete grid, like they can do certain steps of dosing. Because in the end, we'll have to deliver these doses to patients. So some pharmacist has to actually be able to measure it. So what we have in mind, although we don't know it, yeah, somewhere out there, there's here a curve. Here we have the probability of toxicity. Toxicity in this context is often referred to as DLT, where DLT stands for dose limiting toxicity. Simply some nasty stuff happening. Yeah. The more you give, this stuff is poison. So usually the more you give, the higher the chance of suffering the dose-limiting toxicity. And say if you give that much, then you surely lose all your patients. The target is you surely don't want to be somewhere way up here. That would be disastrous. Yeah. You don't want to be all the way down here, because then you might as well ask them to have some water. Yeah. Like nothing is happening. You want to have some toxicity, because that's the whole idea. So here's the target. The accepted target is something like 30. I have another blue. Maybe that's better. Commonly accepted is something like 30%. It's just the rule of thumb. There's no really good reason. And perhaps we should discuss it all in much more detail, because what you should really do is you should really trade off the benefit of being cured, the benefit of killing off the tumor, versus the risk of suffering the toxicity. Yeah? Different patients might have different judgments. Yeah, especially elder patients have a different outlook to these things, and one should probably talk about that. For the moment, let's entirely ignore it, although it's a very important issue. So here's now our mathematical problem. There's this elusive curve here, which we don't know. Yeah, if you knew that, then you wouldn't need any study. What we want to do is we want to find the dose. Let's call it J star. We want to find the dose that delivers around 30% toxicity. That's our problem. Yeah. That dose is usually it's referred to as MTD. That's just an acronym, like maximum tolerated dose. It's a euphemism. It's not really tolerated. There's a 30% chance of toxicity. Yeah. So MTD, this is not math, but it's just jargon that they use. Maximum tolerated. Huh? Dose, I guess. And now here's our math problem. There is a curve like this. We don't know it. How do we find it? Any suggestions? We know, like, we have that new stuff here. I brought you some. God knows what it is. We have that new stuff, and we want to find out. We know that stuff is poison, yeah? So as you give more and more of it, eventually you lose your patience. We want to find that sweet spot, that sweet dose, where it's around 30% chance of the dose-limiting toxicity. How would you do it? Like, it's a real problem. Like, if you become mathematicians or statisticians in your life, and you work in... now UT just has a new plan. We're going to build a medical school, yeah?
Trying to figure out what kind of therapy we're looking at.
Yeah, good question. So we might want to somehow mathematically describe the curve. So say I have a mathematical description for the curve, perhaps, yeah? It's a good comment. Any simpler answer still? Like, how are we going to find that curve? Like, you're sitting in your office in the biostat department in that big research hospital, and the clinician down the hall is asking you, how do we do that? These are very formal things. Like, you're not at liberty to do something entirely arbitrary. There are many people watching you. Yes? So we'll tell our clinician friend, give the drug to 100 patients. What is your clinician friend going to ask back? What will she ask you back? What dose? Because that instruction is useless, right? Like, to actually give it, you have to know what dose. What do we suggest? So that's a good suggestion. Let's recruit 100 patients and give them the nasty stuff and see what happens. But your clinician friend is going to ask back what dose. What should we suggest? Any thoughts? Sorry?
3 milligrams?
Three doses. Is bad. Like, I didn't specify any unit here. You're right. Usually there would be a physical unit. And if you knew the physical unit, you could probably make sense out of it. Could be milligrams, could be milliliter, could be God knows what. But 3 is not a bad idea. What we could do is we could suggest our clinician friend give the nasty stuff at 3 doses. Which 3 doses would you select? Any suggestion? Which 3 doses should I suggest her? She has to write all that up, and there's a whole process. This is not so easy because these are experiments with people, yeah? You can't just do what you want. But so which 3 doses would you suggest her? Sorry? So, no.
It's small, medium, and large.
Small, medium, large is a very, very good answer. You're trying to be nice to me answering my question. The correct answer is stupid question. I have no clue what the, like, if you knew that curve, you could answer it, right? Like, and what you really want is you want something like small, medium, large. Yeah, that's a good thought. But you don't know that curve. This is an elusive thing, yeah? You don't have to immediately try it on humans. That's a very good thought. That's usually done. So usually by the time you're allowed, like, there's all kinds of regulatory bodies who watch you. Before they let you do that with people, they insist that they do it with animals, yeah?
They do generally do it with mice, because mice are non-metal.
Yeah, any other, like, what's your favorite animal to...
Pigs
are not a bad idea, although they rarely seem to use them, yeah? Monkeys sometimes, unfortunately. But so even with animals, it's kind of like you don't want to unnecessarily hurt the animals, so there's also the same kinds of issues. But that's a very good comment. You should not be here. Sorry? No, say.
You could also just get a piece of some sort of tissue to grow the cancer cell on.
Both are very good comments. You are in for a career in the FDA. It's true. Like, nobody will let you try something. They will not let you try something before you can bring some evidence that the stuff works. So first thing you do is like in vitro, like just in the laboratory. You work like with cell lines or something, like just something that's not alive. Yeah. So first you have like lab experiments. In lab experiments, the only limiting factor is your time and money. Yeah. Then you do animal experiments. And you're right, like mice, rats, monkeys sometimes. Now we're already talking about animals. It's not ethical to unnecessarily harm animals. Yeah, we probably should watch it closer than what is currently happening. But so you try it out on animals. And then you have to make the bold leap at some time to humans. Yeah, sometime just in the first in human studies. Very good answer. So his suggestion is, if we had done it before in animals, then we should have some clue of what's small, medium, large. Yeah. So let's say on the basis of doing the nasty stuff with dogs or mice, we know here is small, medium, large, roughly, just a guess. Yeah. What you actually do is, this might get you as mathematicians excited, they have so-called pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic models. There's mathematical models that try to characterize how the body absorbs the drug. That's called pharmacokinetics. That's what the body does to the drug. And then there's another set of formal models that characterize what the drug does to the body. That's pharmacodynamic models. Can you imagine a mathematician can sit down and try to formalize that? And that formalization will involve some unknown numbers, some parameters, like some tuning things, yeah? And then you can try to extrapolate. You can say, for a dog, the rate is something like 0.7. If it's 0.7 for a dog, maybe for a human it's 5 times as much, yeah? But are you all with me? That's like really eyeballing it. But so that's a very good idea. So let's say on the basis of some prior experiments, we know what could be small, medium, large. So now my suggestion to my clinician friend is I'll read like her reports on the earlier lab studies and the animal studies. Then I'll just do some bold extrapolation. I'll say what it does in a rat. Human should be about like 15 times as much kind of the factor. There's some rules of thumb, yeah? On the basis of that, I think this is small, medium, large. And then I'll tell my clinician friend, assign 30 patients here, 30 here, 30 there. Do you think that will fly? Why not? Correct. I mean, these people are going to screen before you assign them to the study. Yeah? So first of all, it's just not ethical. You can't you can't try a poison on people when you think actually it is going to harm them seriously. Yeah? Apart from that, patients have to consent. They have to agree. Yeah? They are not going to agree if you tell them this is our plan. Yeah. aside from that, this is a highly regulated process. Like the hospital has an internal review board. Like there is a committee of people who look at proposals. Like I write a proposal. I want to hit 30 patients here, 30 here, 30 here. That's my plan. They're going to tell me to take a vacation. Yeah. So this is not okay. Yeah. Like you can't kill people. Yeah. Not till, it happens. Yeah. Happens, but not deliberately. Yeah? You have to try to protect your patients as much as you can. But the small, medium, large was not a bad idea. Like I think we are getting there. So next suggestion, how would you do it? Yes?
Give them little bits until it reaches that.
Give them little bits, like you mean every patient increase it?
Yeah.
That's a good suggestion. So we. Everybody heard the suggestion. We could slowly work our way up. There's no need to immediately assign all patients to small, medium, large. If we slowly work our way towards it, of course, we start where? You better start with the low dose. Yeah, the first guy gets water. Yeah, and then you slowly increment it, and you see things happening. Do we all agree with that plan? That sounds reasonably sensible. Yeah. And with that, we might get through. And that's actually one of the things that are being used. So here is the so-called, it's called 3+3 design. And that's already taken into account all the suggestions we had now, yeah? So here's the plan. It's like an algorithm. First, we start out at the lowest dose. J equals 0 is simply water, yeah? Then we assign... Oh, so rather than escalating with inpatient, which is a very difficult game, what's usually done is the escalation is across patients. So the first 3 patients get to take water, or whatever is considered a totally harmless dose. Yeah. So for example, we could use the dose that didn't even harm a monkey. Yeah. Assign 3 patients at dose J. It's not so easy. To assign 3 patients at dose J, you have to get 3 patients who consent to that exercise. And you have to honestly tell them, listen, what you're going to get is probably not going to have any effect whatsoever. Yeah. But in these studies, sometimes they do find patients who are already terminally sick, and they hopefully understand that what they are doing is just for the benefit of medicine and future patients, and they might still consent to do it. A common fear is, if you are terminally sick and your treating doctor tells you, would you sign here? Most people probably misjudge it and think that there is a hope of cure, even when there really isn't. Of course, the small print has to tell them what it is. And they have very explicit rules, like at MD Anderson, since many of the patients are Spanish-speaking, the information has to also be in Spanish. I think Spanish, Vietnamese, you get a choice, yeah? Because they want to make really sure that patients understand what's happening. Yes?
So is it impossible to do a blind study in this case?
Yes. It's unethical, and nobody would consent. Yeah. So I assign 3 patients at that dose, and now the following thing could happen. We want to observe whether or not they get the dose-limiting toxicity. If 0 out of 3 toxicities are observed, then we become bold and we increase it, we escalate the dose to J plus 1, by which I just mean the next dose on our discrete grid. And then we go back and assign the next batch of patients. Sounds okay? Yeah. So you could scream now. If you say 0 out of 3, that looks good, but you could simply have good luck, yeah? I mean, do you realize, so, yeah?
Then do it with 1,000 patients or 100.
Yeah, but that's again unethical. What if the dose is already too high? We are going to do some iteration here. No, good thought. Like, the only way to know for sure is to do it with many, many patients. But doing it with many, many patients before you know is not ethical, yeah? Comment?
When do you look at efficacy? Is it after you get to maximum tolerable?
Good complaint, yeah. The complaint is we are just looking here at nasty stuff. Why the hell? We are only doing the whole thing because in the end we want to do good, yeah? So the problem is until we cannot look at efficacy, we cannot look at cure before we know what dose to give, right? Like now we are trying to work our way up to figure out what dose is safe. And then the next problem, so all this is called phase one. Like, this is only tradition. There is no science to that, yeah? This is a phase one clinical trial. In the phase one clinical trial, we are only trying to work our way up to how high can we push the dose of the poison. In phase two, we'll then try to look whether it does any good, yeah? So you could complain... do you realize if you cross Guadalupe Street with your eyes closed, you might be able to do it 3 times and survive. That doesn't mean it's a good idea, right? So just because you get lucky 3 times doesn't mean that it's necessarily safe. So you could criticize that. And knowing math, we know there might be better ways to do that. We'll still talk about that. Yeah. So if it's 0 out of 3, toxicity is incremented. If it's 2 out of 3, Oh, then obviously we really misjudged it, and the stuff is already way too poisonous. So if it's 0 out of 3, then what we do is, then we declare one dose lower as the MTD, and we end. So it ends with this. In plain English, if it's 2 out of 3, we think we have gone too far. We go one more down, and that's what we recommend our clinician friend, yeah? And, well, then there is one more option. If it's 1 out of 3, what do we conclude when it's 1 out of 3? Yeah, but it's only 3. It's like crossing Guadalupe 3 times, yeah? 1 out of 3, we don't really know. Yeah, 1 out of 3, it could already be the sweet spot that we are looking after. We could have just gotten lucky, or maybe just shit happened. Yeah, maybe the thing is totally safe, but well, there's these patients who are enrolling these trials, these are terminally sick patients typically. They have all kinds of comorbidities. You never know what happened. Yeah? Sorry, 1 second, yeah? Go ahead.
So I suppose J plus minus 0, then repeat.
Sorry, J.
So.
Oh, J could go. You could be in the embarrassing situation that you have J equals 0, and the recipe calls for going to J minus 1. Too bad. Sorry? Good suggestion. I'm going to probably do exactly that. What was your comment? Was that what you meant?
Well, I'm supposing that we could just be skeptical, think, oh, it happened by luck, and repeat it again.
Good suggestion. Does that sound reasonable to everyone? Yeah?
Is there anything that limits the number of patients that are studied in the very first phase?
Money. It's not cheap. Ethics, it's unethical to unnecessarily harm patients when we don't hope to learn anything. Time, to recruit such patients is not easy. There are many opportunity costs. We are not the only team working here in the hospital. There are many others who might have better treatments. So yes, resources. Yeah. So that was a good thought. 1 out of 3, let's assign a few more and look again. That's exactly the idea. So I assign 3 more. After we have assigned 3 more, we could see either the 1 out of 3 plus 0 out of the additional 3. So if it is 1 out of 3 and 0 out of the additional 3, then we are just going to say, well, that was just bad luck on the first batch, yeah? Like, these are seriously ill patients. They might suffer the toxicities also for other reasons. So if in the next 3 nothing happens, we say we go 1 higher, we escalate, and we continue the game, yeah? If it is 1 out of 3 and... another time again, 1 out of 3 in the next batch. So if you see now a total of 2 out of 6, well, if you see a total of 2 out of 6, 6 is not yet the 1,000 we would love to see. But we can't afford the 1,000 for ethical reasons, time, money, everything, yeah? So once we have seen 2 out of 6, let's say, well, that could be the MTD. That could be the sweet spot we are after. So declare J as the MTD. And there's one more option. What if we see 1 out of 3 and 2 out of 3 in the next batch? Sorry, I don't have more space, so this is the last option I can allow. if there's 1 out of 3 and 2 out of 3 in the second batch, what would you do? Well, then it seems we have gone too far. Now we have lost 3 out of 6 patients. Means there might be toxicity up to like 50%, which is just simply too much. So in that case, let's also pull the brake, the emergency brake, and declare J minus 1 as the MTD. And of course, with 3 out of 3, we also do the same thing. We also have gone too far. Yeah? That's it. This is called the 3 plus 3 design. It's still a very commonly used design for phase 1 clinical trials. How do you feel about it? I mean, it's not unreasonable. We kind of worked our way towards it, just arguing what is sensible and ethical. But as a mathematician, how do you feel about this exercise?
So, can I ask the question?
Yes.
What is toxicity in this, in phase one? Is it?
Could be death. Could be death. Yeah. Okay. Could be like just hematologic, like some blood count gets like dangerously low.
Okay, so there would be a defined that, okay, this is toxicity in this study.
Good point. The whole algorithm, it's very important, and they watch your fingers on that. You have to spell out what the DLT is, yeah? And that depends on the type of cancer, on the type of poison and everything. So as mathematicians, how do you feel about that recipe?
It's like walking into a room blind.
Yes. And not using all the math you could, right? And it's not unreasonable. Like, this is not nasty. It's not criminal doing that, yeah? We do it a lot all over the country, yeah? But see what we are really doing here is we are assigning patients. Like, we start here, then we might see, let's do that in green. I'm going to draw a possible course of what might happen. So I'll do all my assigned doses in green, and I'll also mark then these guys. So in green is here the number of toxicities. So see, at the first dose I have 0 toxicities, then at the second dose still 0 toxicities, third dose we see 1 toxicity, say here is 1, 2, 3, then 2, then 1, then maybe we go, then maybe 1, 3, so something like this. I realize things are not coherent now. Yeah, do you see? This is what you get to see. Like, you don't get to see the curve. You only get to see how many toxicities happen. You get to see either 1 or 2 or 0. That's what you see. So with these green dots, do you see that with these green dots? There's one thing we could do. There's one thing that statisticians are really good about. Mathematicians less so, because they're not practical. Yeah. Don't report it to your math teachers, yeah? So if you have, these are the responses. Does everybody understand how that is meant? This is like 1 out of 3, 0 out of 3, 2 out of 3, 3 out of 3. When you have these dots, it's pretty easy to fit a smooth curve through a bunch of dots, right? The blue curve, you don't know. Don't look at the blue thing. The blue thing is not for us to see. Nature knows it, yeah? But the green thing we see, seeing the green thing, I mean, I could guess now it might be, must look something like this, right? Yes? Oh, sorry, you're just yawning. Maybe we can do better than that, yeah? Do you see that there's a problem when we declare the MTD? When we declare the MTD, we're only using the last batch practically, right? We're not making use of the earlier batches. But all the data is there, and that data is expensive data. Patients volunteered their lives for it, yeah? Yeah? Yeah?
Go ahead. So we could just do regression then?
We could do so. Some of you might know fitting a smooth curve through a bunch of points. In Latin, it's also called regression, yeah? So we could fit a regression through the observed data, and that might be a smarter thing to do. And that is done. But to fit a regression, like to intelligently fit a line through that, you want to do something like you want to fit a line that minimizes those little residuals, those little gaps, right? You want to fit the best line. Some of you had calculus already, or do you do calculus in school? So there's a whole part of math. There's a whole story in math of how to solve problems of the kind maximizing something, yeah? But clinicians can't do that, yeah? For that, you need someone who is mathematically trained, who can do that coherently, intelligently, and most efficiently in a way. Because being efficient about that, maybe we can learn about the MTD if you can learn about the MTD with five patients fewer, you are a hero, because for those five patients you have saved them a lot of grief. It's cheaper. You can proceed faster, because then you're able to proceed to the next step faster and all that. Yeah. This took much longer than what I had planned. But nothing wrong. Yeah. So I plan to talk now next thing at the end of this scheme. What we really have is we typically have then a batch of six patients, and we know the number of toxicities among the six patients. So here's a formal problem. Like at the end of this, at the end of the 3 plus 3, what you might typically have is you might know that you had two toxicities out of six patients. Things like that, you know, right? And then I was going to ask you, when you have two out of six toxicities, what's your guess what the toxicity is? Like, this is just what you happen to observe. It's like crossing Guadalupe six times, yeah, and you die twice. Oops. because it's two out of six doesn't mean that the probability of toxicity is a third. When you observe two out of six patients report toxicity, I think a reasonable guess would be that the probability of toxicity for the next patient whom you assign at this dose might be around 2 out of 6, means 2 over 6. How is your algebra? 2 over 6 is, I hope it's better than mine, 1 out of 3. So the probability of toxicity is probably somewhere around a third. That's a good guess, yeah? And then I was just going to talk you through some argument that this guess is really very uncertain. Yeah, it could just as well be 1 out of 6 or 3 out of 6.
Or 4 out of 6.
4 out of 6 is good point. I give you more. How about 6 out of 6? Could it be 6 out of 6?
No.
Anyone willing to take a bet? I bet when you see 2 out of 6 toxicities, the probability of toxicity could be 6 out of 6. Anyone willing to take my bet?
No. The probability could not be 6 out of 6.
Because?
Because if it were 6 out of 6, it's a guarantee, so you would not see 2 out of 6.
Bingo. So you should have taken my bet. You should have said, I bet you $100. It's not, yeah? No, you're absolutely right. Your argument is perfect. 6 out of 6 is probability 1. Probability 1 is a complicated way of saying certainty. Yeah. So toxicity 6 out of 6 means you surely killed a patient. Yeah. So there's no way that 4 of them survive. Yeah. Think about it, like how would you characterize how sure you are about that? Yeah. So 6 out of 6 is not possible. That we ruled out. Yeah. By the same token, we can rule out 0 out of 6. Because if it were 0 out of 6, if nobody ever suffers the dose-limiting toxicity, how come I see 2, yeah? Yeah?
Could you construct their confidence interval?
That is the clean answer, yeah? So the clean answer to how certain are you about that estimate is, you go through a formal quantitative mathematical argument to characterize your uncertainty. The important thing is, with six patients, nothing is certain, nothing is sure. Well, unless you have a situation like this, yeah? There's a lot of uncertainty. When you only see 6 outcomes, there are lots of uncertainties because there's a lot of sampling variation, yeah? Like, maybe you just got lucky, yeah? And with the next 6 patients, it would be 5 out of 6. And characterizing these uncertainties, that's probability. And so do they teach you probability in high school here? Like, probability calculus is a very powerful thing, yeah? Because there's lots of mistakes you can do if you just try to intuitively work with probabilities. If you can manipulate them in a coherent, mathematically well-defined way, you can gain a lot, especially this is about people, yeah? I think we agree you should do the best you can, yeah? So my overall plan was to talk a little bit about, so now we know what's the best dose, yeah? Now we know J equals 3 is the MTD, the dose that we want to use, yeah? Then the next step is phase two. In phase two, we take that recommended dose and we try to see whether it does any good. See, there's another problem. For this trial, you can't use healthy volunteers because you can't use healthy volunteers for this trial. Or you have to use, like, really, depending on what it is, you might use, like, terminally sick patients who just volunteer for the benefit of science, yeah? Or for the benefit of future patients. People do that because if you know there's... So there's no hope for any help for these people, yeah? They might not even have the cancer that you want to cure, but they might have another one, yeah? So to find out whether this stuff works, we move to a phase two study. And in a phase two study, now we are looking not at the nasty stuff, now we are looking at the good stuff. Now we are trying to see whether we can see any efficacy there. So efficacy is, typical definition now is, success is if your tumor shrinks by more than 30%. See, it's easy for us to talk about does the stuff work or not, yeah? But when you really want to put numbers to it, you have to be specific what you mean, yeah? So say what we mean is, if the tumor shrinks by more than 30% within the next 20 days, then we call it a success. So now our outcome is success. And now we actually recruit patients who have the tumor of interest. And those patients, there's now a hope for cure because now we will use, try to use the MTD that was suggested there. Now, this is suggested because it's still safe to give. That doesn't mean it will necessarily kill the tumor, yeah? So here's a typical thing that's done now. So in phase two, we are looking for efficacy. I'm back to the bad blue, right? Not the all bad. So we still have the problem that we have to find the dose that is good for the efficacy, for the success. So say here is dose now. Say somewhere here might be our J star. So we know we can't go beyond J star. Going beyond J star is not acceptable, yeah? But now we don't know what's now the best dose in terms of doing what we want. There's somewhere in the background, so here's now the probability of success, the probability of efficacy, where success is formally defined as the thing shrinks more than 30% within the next 20 days. And somewhere in the background, there's this elusive curve. We don't know it, yeah? What we are after then is, so what we want to do now is, you know, one way of getting rid of your tumor, kill the patient, yeah? Then, so you could give, like, excessive dose, and that would surely do it. But you want to avoid excessive dose because of all the nasty side effects. So what you typically want to do is, you want to do something like, you want to find a dose that delivers, say, 90% of the maximum possible effect, yeah? Say in the extreme case, the probability of success could be, well, it depends what it is. So say we want to have this dose where you get around, can you eyeball that with me? Like the maximum you can get is that. And say we want to chase after the dose that gives you around 90% of the maximum. Because in the end, the thing gets very flat. To get better and better, you have to give much, much more poison. So you want to kind of trade it off. So for the moment, let's say Xavier after the dose that gives you 90%. So here is one thing that's done. Now we want to do dose finding. We want to find the dose that we want to recommend. Like in the end, when you sell the stuff at CVS or whatever, whatnot, like some recommendation goes on the package, right? They tell you take so many of that stuff, right? So we have to find out how many should we recommend. What's typically done now is there's a grid of doses. Now we are after good stuff happening. So now it's ethical to assign patients like small, medium, large, yeah? And then we can see the responses, and from that we can try to estimate the curve. So here's now one suggestion, and that's actually it's not uncommon. Trying to find an effective dose, trying to find a dose that delivers success. We could use a grid of doses and assign patients on that grid. And then we get the responses. Maybe nobody responds here, some respond here, many more respond here. And then we kind of fit the curve and we declare victory, right? How do you feel about that suggestion?
But what I'm curious about is how did you know to expect a success within 20 days? Remember when you said earlier, you know, success is when the tumor shrinks within 20 days?
Right. It's a bit arbitrary. Like the hope is that chemotherapy is simply poison. The hope is that poison goes to the tumor and the tumor will shrink. It might not. There's uncertainty. It might never happen. Maybe. So he's saying maybe the true curve could actually be like that. Might just never happen, yeah? The poison just kills you and not the tumor, yeah? So you really never know for sure. Why exactly 20 days? Totally arbitrary, but we have to specify something, yeah? So that's already one comment. The thing might not work at all, yeah? It might just kill patients but not tumors. Any other thought? Sorry?
Recurrence of the disease.
Good point. Like when we define success as the tumor shrinks within 20 days, first of all, it might come back. That's unfortunate. That's an unfortunate truth. Many tumors, they might shrink, and then they are back. Second, tumor shrinkage might not be related to survival. Yeah, like the tumor might shrink, and you might still die. Yeah. The reason why they look at something like, so you're critiquing, you're commenting on using the criterion of tumor shrinkage of 30%. The reason why you use that is because you can observe it relatively fast, 20 days. Overall survival might take months or years. It's well defined, you can measure it. What you really want is you want overall survival. What you really, really want is you want overall survival and quality of life, yeah? Like many patients might choose a less aggressive treatment if they have overall survival a little less, but better quality of life, yeah? Good comment, yeah? So the choice of that criterion is a bit arbitrary, but like in many instances in statistics, this is about making decisions in the face of uncertainty. Not making a decision carries a huge cost, because then we treat nobody, yeah? We want to make a decision relatively fast, because otherwise no drug developer will sustain that, blah, blah, blah. Yeah? But any other comments to that scheme? So one comment was already the curve might actually be flat. See, another problem is the curve might actually be steep. It might be like this. It might actually go like, someone asked me implicitly, what's the dose, what's the units here, milligram or something? Sometimes you're totally in the dark here, and maybe the true curve is something like this. Then our grid is way too coarse, right? We might totally miss the action. Or the stuff might work immediately. Then we totally miss the action, like we are assigning all these patients there. So using a fixed grid is not necessarily a smart idea, yeah? What you might ideally want to do is some smart and clever twist. Does anybody have a suggestion for a smart and clever twist? If any of these happen, yeah, this is a flop because it's just flat. We are assigning 100 patients on an evenly spaced grid, and in the end we just learn it was a flop. That happens, yeah? This is also a flop because all these patients whom we assigned way out here and way down there, they're totally lost in many ways, yeah? This is also a flop because our doses were way unnecessarily high. We are harming these patients totally unnecessarily. Does somebody have a suggestion how to avoid these flops?
You can try needle points.
Sorry?
You can try needle every time you divide it by 2.
You mean when you say every time, you mean try to find a grid or.
Firstly, you start with the middle of the MPP and find out whether it's too large or too small. And then if it's too small, you choose the left half and divide it by two.
So the suggestion is start out somewhere and don't commit yet where you will assign the next patients. Make a decision for the first patient cohort for logistics reasons. Yeah?
What about trying a minimal number of patients at each dose level and then increase your testing where you see the best results?
Something like that is exactly where we are headed, yeah? So the main idea is assign some small cohort of patients, make a decision for a first cohort, observe the outcomes, and then only you make it. So if the outcome is they all respond, if the outcome is way up here, then the next dose we might want to choose way down, right? And what you suggested were reasonable ad hoc schemes. Are you mathematicians with me that we can try to do that in a way optimally? So there's a complicated scheme of making decisions, observing outcomes. See, the problem is, what's the optimal thing to do next depends on what you do down the road. We very quickly run into a difficult problem where you have a sequence of decisions, a sequence of outcomes, and the optimal thing you do now depends on what will happen in the end. Any of you play chess? When you play chess, when you plan your next move, when you plan the optimal move, where to place your piece, the kind of thoughts you go through, what could I do next, what will the other guy do next, and maybe you go like 5 moves ahead, and then you see what could happen 5 moves ahead, and then you slowly work your way back to the present, right? Has anyone done that before when you play chess? Or just use the computer? But so when you really play chess, that's what you do, right? You think of what could happen next, and then you kind of work your way back. What's the optimal thing to do so that you can win in the end? These things are called sequential decisions, and I plan to talk you through one, but this is not going to happen at a given time. I'm told we have a break sometimes in between. Is this a good time? So then this was phase 1 and 2, and then the next thing is phase 3. We'll talk about phase 3. And that will probably take us the last 30 minutes or whatnot, yeah? Yeah? Let me just share. I would like to share that with you if I can figure out how to project it on the screen. Does anyone know how I can log in here on the podium? Like, what's the password? That's an informed guess, or?
Yeah,
but they even want the username. Wait, I think I'll try one more with this here. I should be able to somehow. It's splitting the screen, and so you can't see what I'm seeing here. I think now I'm running around on the. It's getting better. I'm getting there, yeah? Oh, that looks better. It's not the one I want. Who of you knows what Spitfires are? I had no clue, yeah? But so it seems Spitfires, those were fighter planes of the British Royal Air Force during World War II. They used a lot of these, yeah? So these are just fighter planes that the British Air Force used. And when they flew their missions, like many of them came back with damage from enemy fire. They lost many, like many unfortunately didn't come back. And so here is what the British High Command considered at one time. those brains came back, yeah, with lots of damage, like they take a lot of enemy fire. They wanted to do something about these massive losses. What they did was they just had like the data set where they saw like on all the planes where they took damage, where they took fire. Wouldn't it be a good idea to reinforce the locations where you get a lot of damage?
No.
Okay. Two votes for no. Yeah.
I think it would be better to reinforce the safe since you get a lot of damage, and it looks like you get a lot of damage to the wheels.
And the wheels might not be so important after all, because as long as they come back, they'll get them down safe and sound. So two votes for do not reinforce where the damage occurs. Where would you reinforce?
Where it doesn't occur.
Where it doesn't occur. Comment?
So what was the question again, sir?
These are fighter planes that the Royal Air Force used like in huge numbers. They lost many of them, yeah? Like they flew over to the continent, they lost many. Some came back, they came back with heavy damage. To reduce the damage and losses, the British High Command, in their infinite wisdom, considered to reinforce. They looked at the damaged planes, and they considered to reinforce the spots where they took a lot of damage. We have two votes. That's not a good idea. One vote, maybe. Any other comments on it? Yeah. Oh, because you don't have access, Dave.
Well, yeah, but it would make more sense to reinforce the ones that didn't come back. The places
good point. But they felt like they lost them over Germany or something. They don't have access, yeah? Comments back there, but good thought, yeah?
Why wouldn't they just like take off it and make it more speed? So
it's expensive, and there was obviously time pressure. But, I mean, good comment. You would want to redesign the next generation of... those were still prop planes, right? I didn't see it now. Does anybody know Spitfires or prop planes or jets? So the next generation of planes, they might want to design differently, but this is just about the quick fix, like Band-Aid for those planes, yeah? Any other comment was there? So how would you characterize the data that the British High Command sees, yeah? What kind of data do they get? There's something funny about that data. Yeah?
They get data from the planes that tell you this is where a plane can be hit and come back.
Good point. So one comment is, maybe the spots where they took damage, that's okay. It's like when you see the cars circulate here in Austin, like my car has a bump on the left front, another big bump on the right back. It doesn't really matter. It's still running, yeah? So obviously these spots where it can continue flying with damage, they don't need reinforcement, yeah? Does somebody want to characterize it like something very systematic is happening here? Bias, a very bad thing, yeah? Or even worse, it's so-called selection sampling. Let me ask you a different question. How do you feel about jumping off the Congress Bridge? It's not a good idea, yeah? On the other hand, don't do it, yeah? On the other hand, you could argue, I have never met anyone who died jumping off the Congress Bridge. Have you met anyone who died? You obviously didn't, because there is selection sampling. You don't meet people who die, yeah? Many of you obviously caught on to that. They have massive selection sampling. The planes that got hit in the sensitive parts, they didn't come back. So the data that they see is a selection sample. It was actually, so at that time, a British statistician at the time, really advised the British High Command, no, reinforce the spots where you do not see any damage. Because those are obviously the critical ones. Not as stupidly like, don't reinforce the decoration or whatnot, yeah? But talk with the engineers what could be sensitive spots. And then sensitive spots where you don't see damage, those are the areas to reinforce. Because obviously, when those areas are hit, the planes didn't come back, yeah? And I think some of you caught on to that. And all the other suggestions were good too. Yeah, like obviously you want to redesign. Or your suggestion was good. Guys, you have the wrong data. Get the right data. Yeah, they have to send someone to Germany and just take photos of the planes that went down. Yeah, but obviously there wasn't that much time, or they couldn't do that. Yeah. So selection sampling—that's the problem. Yeah. Sorry, I couldn't resist that. And that's a serious problem. Like in this case, it's blatant. Yeah. And you laughed at me when I asked you, "Did you meet anyone who died?" Of course, you don't meet people who died. Yeah. But the same systematic, mathematically, the same principle acts in many other cases, and people are not careful. We talked about phase one, that was trying to find the safe dose. Phase two, trying to understand whether there's some efficacy happening. And now we are moving. So let's assume we have been through phase one, we have been through phase two with all the problems. Like, I think we agree that you can do smarter things than a fixed grid. Let's assume we know now this is the dose. This is the dose that we want to put into the package that goes to CVS or whatnot, yeah? But before they let you sell it at CVS, I mean, this is medicine, this is medication, these are drugs. Before they let you sell it, you have to get approval. There's a federal agency, the FDA, who supposedly watch out for the public interest. Like, we don't want anyone to sell drugs just because they think they can make money on it, yeah? You want to make sure that there's a probability police, also known as mathematicians and statisticians, who watch that. Yeah, you don't want anyone to use stupid data like the planes there. Yeah, that gets us to phase three. So when a drug company or a drug developer is trying to develop a new drug, they first go through these early phase studies. In these early phase studies, the federal agency doesn't watch you. Like, you have to be ethical and you can't be criminal, yeah? And all institutions have, like, review boards who make sure that that you don't do foolish things. But that's not yet a public interest issue of the same order of magnitude as when you were to market that. Then also phase two, you still do, like, in research institutions. But then the next step is you want to sell the stuff, yeah? So now we have the dose that we want, and we think it could work, and we want to sell it. If you want to sell it, you have to prepare a formal report that you submit to the FDA, to the Food and Drug Administration. The FDA, they have mathematicians and statisticians sit there who scrutinize the reports. They look at the data. They look at the conclusion. They check that all the probabilities are right. And if you pass that hurdle, then you get to market your drug, and then you get the pot of gold as a drug developer, yeah? And hopefully society gets the pot of gold, because if the drug is really effective, we want it to be available, right?
Well, wait, sir, so how do you know that that's the right dose to send out the
good point. Very good point. There's lots of uncertainty. And in your report, you have to characterize these uncertainties. If you don't characterize them, they'll send it back, yeah? You will never be certain, because to be certain, you would need thousands of patients. And here is a sad thing. So you go through the whole process. The next step is in the phase three trial, where you try to convince the FDA, and then the stuff gets sold. And now tens of thousands or millions of patients might take your drug. Then you might suddenly see things that you hadn't seen before, and you might have to recall a drug. That happens. You must have seen it in the newspaper here and there, right? So you never know for sure, and you can be wrong, yeah? It's possible that when the drug actually gets sold and you get the massive data from many people taking it, at that time you might find out there were severe adverse events that you didn't know about, or your judgment was wrong, and you have to recall the drug, and too bad, yeah? But we are not yet there. We are not yet... the drug is not yet on the market. We still have to go the last hurdle, which is to convince the regulatory agency. And convincing the regulatory agency, that's a very structured process, yeah? Because this is about people's lives and safety. And that gets us to phase three. So on that little handout that's on the third page, I'll talk you through that process a little bit. Then I'll describe you some problems with it too, and that's about as far as we'll get a bit. Gee, it's already 11:30. What's my instructions like? Before 12 or so, we should wrap up, right? Sorry?
We usually end right at
noon.
You have what?
We usually end right at noon.
At 12 noon. Okay, high noon we'll end, yeah? Now comes the phase 3 trial. That's also known as the regulatory or confirmatory trial. That's when we want to now enroll many more patients at the dose that we eventually want to sell, yeah? Because we have to make sure that thing is efficacious. So at that moment, what we want to do is we want to now compare our experimental therapy, let's call it, simply, we want to compare our drug versus the standard of care. Standard of care is simply current treatment, yeah? If it's an important disease, chances are there's some drug already in current use, and we just claim that our drug is better. So now here's the problem. We claim our drug is better. The FDA is watching us. The FDA is very skeptical. That is their mandate. They have to be skeptical. The FDA is skeptical. They think your drug is nothing better than standard of care. You shouldn't sell it, yeah? So what we have to do now is we have to settle that dispute, right? If you're the drug developer, you want to market it because it's very expensive to get to this stage, yeah? You added additional requirements. You told me I have to do lab experiments, I have to do animal experiments, I have to do phase 1 to find out the stuff is safe, I have to do phase 2 to find the right dose or to find that it can do something. Until you get there, you've pumped a lot of money into it, yeah? It's even worse. To get there with one hopeful drug, you probably have to look at, I don't know the numbers, you probably have to look at 20 candidates before you get one that looks promising. Does anybody happen to know the numbers? How many flops before you get one that looks good? I don't know, it's shocking numbers, yeah? They have to go through lots of flops before they eventually get one that looks good. And now we get to that stage that we have to make a formal argument. And that formal argument, it's almost like a courtroom scenario, yeah? By default, the FDA maintains that your thing is nothing better than standard of care. That's like the innocence assumption, yeah? Like the drug is presumed innocent. It does nothing, yeah? Only if you can demonstrate beyond reasonable doubt that the drug does something, then the FDA will reject drop its skepticism. It will reject the standard assumption and concede that something might be going on. You can sell it, yeah? And they do that for the public good because obviously there are commercial interests to sell stuff, yeah? And you have to watch that. And there's a very, very regulated process, and I'll talk. It starts first on the handout. I think you also did that. It first starts by giving names. We have to give names to our... There's two competing hypotheses, innocence and guilt, right? Sorry. Only as good as standard of care or our experimental therapy is better. So H naught is like the default assumption of innocence. Let's make an assumption now. The outcome that we measure, now we have to get serious. You guys were uncommon, yeah? Yes, which might be nothing.
Oh, is nothing?
It might be. Depends on the disease. Like Alzheimer, there's nothing you can do. The standard of care is nothing.
But if there's let's say there's a drug that exists, and I have a drug that's just as good, but I'm going to produce it more cheaply. They won't let me do it if it's just as good. I have to be better than the other drug?
Very good, very good comment. So this is getting, this was a paid for question, yeah? earlier you guys were uncomfortable with just the binary outcome, just the success or failure, yeah? FDA is also uncomfortable with that because just shrinking the tumor is not something that we should throw on the market, yeah? We should only throw it on the market and make people take it if you can actually demonstrate that it gives you like a benefit in terms of survival, yeah? So now they insist the typical outcome now is that we look at overall survival. And let's assume that for the standard of care, the average survival on the standard of care, the average of survival is M0 equal say 20 months, depending what it is, yeah. And here's the unknown average survival for my drug, it's M1. And that's a typical outcome that the FDA uses. Now, then we'll compare it. What's coming up now is a ritual that's like a courtroom proceedings to figure out who wins, yeah. And your comment was, maybe survival is not everything. Maybe we should look at least at quality-adjusted life years, like surviving 5 years in coma is not the same as surviving. What do you prefer? 5 years in five years in bed. You can't leave your bed versus 3 years of reasonably mobile. It's a tough question. You don't want to necessarily decide it for every patient. Everyone has it. People have different views on that, and that's fine, yeah? And you go even one step further. You ask the question, who is going to pay that, yeah? It's a very good question. The FDA has a legal mandate, yeah? They are only allowed to look at efficacy. They are not allowed to look at cost. Go and vote, yeah? In some countries, do they use what you might want to look at is dollars per quality adjusted life year, yeah? And if it is, and you only approve the drug if the dollars per quality adjusted life year is beyond something. I mean, here's a sad truth that stuff costs, yeah? Somewhere down the road, you have to somehow implicitly make a decision, do we pay it or not? Assuming that most patients are covered by insurance, and so in some way everyone pays, right? It should probably be a it's a political process to decide that, yeah? In the UK, they look at, it's called cost effectiveness. You look at the number of pounds per quality adjusted life year. In Canada too, I believe. In the US, I think not yet. At least the FDA is not, you're allowed to obviously collect data on it and do research on it, yeah? But it's not used for policy decisions, yeah? That's simply the constraint. Like this has to, do you all understand this has to be a very cleanly described process because there's competing interests. There's the interests of the patients. The patient simply wants to get cured usually, yeah? There's the interest of the drug developer who has to, they have to recover their costs, otherwise they can't continue the process, which in the end is good for all of us because no drug developer, no new drugs, yeah? There's the federal regulator who really get into the doghouse if they approve a drug for marketing that turns out to be a flop. They look really bad, yeah? That's their interest. There's the interest of the researchers who are behind this. They want to publish their papers, yeah? It's a minefield. So there has to be a well-defined process, only then you can go through it. So I'm with you. It's not obvious that survival is the necessary endpoint. To some degree, that's legally mandated, yeah? And we don't have a choice. But it's something that should be discussed, yeah? It's very reasonable to look at different things. So now we are down to considering survival. Say average survival on the standard of care is 20 months. And the question is this one doing any better? So here is the innocence hypothesis, age not, is that M1 is nothing better than M0. Like, by default, unless we have evidence beyond reasonable doubt, we'll assume that your drug is nothing better than the one that's already on the market. And here's the competing hypothesis, call it H1, which is that M1 is greater than M0, which means the new drug is better. You can still discuss that greater alone is not enough. A survival benefit of 1 week is probably not enough, blah, blah, blah. You might insist on some clinically minimum meaningful improvement. Those are all reasonable things to ask for. The thing is not symmetric. The red thing, innocence, is the default. The FDA will only decide for... yeah? Then that's really bad, yeah? But good comment. So you're suggesting maybe we should actually say less than or equal. Like in either case, you don't want to market it, right? And that's actually possible, yeah? It happens, yeah? You can buy expensive stuff that's worse than the standard of care. So this is the problem. And the logic. So this kind of framework has a formal name. It's called hypothesis testing. And if you end up going to, do they teach hypothesis testing in high school? Does anybody know?
Yeah.
Oh, so you'll hear it again when you go to college and you take STAT 101, which hopefully you can test out of if you have heard it already. They'll talk you through hypothesis testing. It takes a long time to talk through all of it and all the recipes. And there's many more things you can do with it, and that's one of the things that mathematicians and statisticians do. Depending on what assumptions you make, you could, yeah? So there is all different kinds of tests. They have names, and one of them is the C-test, yeah? But we're not going to get into those details. But so here's the logic, or here's in plain English the instructions. We're only going to reject the innocence, we're only going to reject H-naught. Only if there's evidence beyond reasonable doubt. Or in other words, if the observed data is really unlikely under H-naught. If the defendant shows up in court with blood dripping down the fingers, yeah? It's just very unlikely to have blood running down your fingers if you're not guilty, yeah? And this has to be beyond reasonable doubt. And we'll have to quantify all of that, yeah? In plain text, if the average survival for standard of care is 20... And say if we have 500 patients in our trial, and if the average of those 500 patients, if the average survival is 21 months, do you think the FDA will let you sell the stuff? Probably not, because 21 is probably not beyond reasonable doubt. How about, if our average survival in our 500 patients is 21, I think we agreed that is not going to fly. Other extreme, if average survival for our 500 patients is 40 months, question, is that going to fly? That looks quite convincing, right? So probably yes.
Wait, but that's longer than the original time.
So, yeah, which you want. It's survival, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
No, good. It's good to always ask back what's the outcome, yeah? But so this is stuff you want more, usually. Depends on what. Well, survival, like as somebody brought up, not all survival is the same, yeah? I mean, I might prefer 21 months leading a regular, a normal life than 40 months in coma, yeah? clear where the problem arises. Now, what do you do with 25? It becomes delicate, right? The question is now, where do we draw the line, right? Like, where do we draw the line? Where do we start to give green light? And here's the recipe. And I think that is on your sheet, although I forgot one step. First of all, we have to, a first step is we fix what reasonable doubt means, yeah? Typical one is we allow, say, alpha equal 1%. So if the data is very unlikely, say only 1% chance, if in the red world there's only a 1% chance of seeing your data, then we say that's beyond reasonable doubt, we are okay, and we go ahead. Question, before we go into more details.
1% or
0.01%? Touche, 1%. question, why do we have to allow that 1%? That 1% means if you sell that stuff to 10,000 people. If you sell the stuff to 10,000 people, there is 1% chance that you sell to 10,000 people something that doesn't work at all, yeah? Or kind of the equivalent of 100 people, it doesn't work, yeah? Why do we have to allow reasonable doubt? Can't we simply insist on you have to show that it's for sure better? Yeah? Fellow statistician, yeah? There is no such thing as certainty in life, yeah? You're never going to know for sure. Even when you have 500 patients on your trial, later on, when you see millions of patients buying that stuff, you might see you were wrong. That happens, yeah? When you have to make decisions in the face of uncertainty, yeah? Comment? Now, that would be a solution, but it's expensive. How many are we today? 5 billion something? Or are we 6 billion already?
7 billion.
7 billion. Last time I looked, it was 5 billion. So, in principle, yes. So, in principle, it's a finite population. We could. In practice, no. Yeah. So there are some drugs like aspirin or so. So many people are taking that. You could practically say the entire world population. Yeah. But even then, it's not only about science. This is also about cooperation. Like 1 billion people take aspirin in India, yeah? The companies that sell it there, they might not cooperate with the companies that sell it here because they have different business interests. That's a serious problem that FDA cannot require you to compare your data with competitor data, yeah? Although from a society perspective, like Alzheimer, many companies are trying to develop a cure for Alzheimer because it's a huge market, yeah? Wouldn't it be good if they could all work together for the common good? Yet the FDA can't ask them for that, yeah? So that's a good comment. So the problem is when you have to make a decision in the face of uncertainty, if you insist on never making a mistake, the only way to proceed is stay at home and never make a decision, yeah? And that has an enormous cost. Never making a decision means you don't sell any drugs. So you have to allow for some probability of making a mistake. There's no way around that. It's an important concept. There's nothing, it's not rocket science, yeah? But you have to accept, you have to allow for some probability of making a mistake. Otherwise, if you're overly skeptical and never permit any drug to go on the market, then there are no drugs you can buy in the drugstore, yeah? So we have to allow some probability of making a mistake, say we take 1%. The next thing is we find, sorry, this doesn't work at all anymore. I'll switch. So black usually sticks really badly. And it's also becoming faint. How about the green one? Sorry. It's still fresh, yeah? So what next thing we do is we find the average survival of the patients in our phase 3 trial, yeah? Of patients on the experimental therapy, so on the drug. Say in our case, say it is M equal 12 or say 14. Just we'll play through two cases, yeah? So first fix what reasonable doubt is, then see your data, find the average survival of the patients on your drug. Then the next thing is we find, and for that you need a little bit of statistics and probability. You find what the distribution of average survival in the red world is. Yeah. Find possible average survival under the standard of care. And so this is what it might look like in the red world. And in that case, for that step, you need a statistician or someone to do that. It's not difficult, but you can show, like it looks like a histogram, and I plotted you one there on that little handout. Do you all know what a histogram is? Like a histogram is a way of summarizing data. Like if you were to repeat that same experiment 1,000 times, then say most of the time your average would be around 10. Sometimes your average is bigger, sometimes your average is smaller. So that's I'm a little bit on thin ice with some of you now, probably, yeah? Because if you have heard it, it's trivial. Yeah? If you have never heard it, it's pushing it a bit. So from somewhere you have to get like a histogram of possible average survivals. And for those of you who know how to get there, great. If you don't, there is a well-defined process by which you get a histogram of possible average survivals. Now we get down to the business of formalizing that reasonable doubt and drawing the line. See, we say reasonable doubt is 1%, so what we do is we chase down like the 1%, the far right 1%. If you look at that little thing here, there's like a little histogram there. And when I stare at that, I think the top 1% must be a little bit below 14. So 1%, I think, cuts to just below 14, right? Someone else told me before, 100% is the sure thing, yeah? So all together must be 100%. Sometimes with 1% probability, your average survival might be way out there. So what we did here was a histogram of average survival. Did somebody want to comment on the histogram of average survival? I kind of feel I probably didn't explain it nicely. Does somebody want to say it in different words?
So are you saying that you're sure that 1% of your patients who take this drug will survive?
Good way to put it. If we had many, many patients taking the standard of care, the red one, we are in the red world now. If we had many, many patients take the red drug, and we look at averages of, I never said how many patients are in our trial. N equal 100 patients. Then we have many, many patients in the red world, and we see if we take averages of 100, what can we see? Sometimes we see 10, sometimes we see 14, sometimes you might see 8. That's what this is. Does somebody want to say it in different words, what this picture shows? Come on, somebody try it in better. Yeah, go ahead.
It kind of looks like a Gaussian distribution.
It's the most beautiful of all. It's the normal, it's the Gaussian, yeah? But that's an insider comment. Anyone want to? No, it's correct, yeah? It's a bell shape. It's also known as the bell shape. But does somebody want to repeat, say in different words, what this thing is? For those of you who haven't had any probability and statistics. Yes?
When there's some unknown average for the whole population, it's the probability of getting each specific average along the way in your samples of 100.
Perfect. It's on the if you take samples of 100, if you repeatedly take samples of 100 patients from the red population in the red world, then this characterizes the probabilities of getting different sample averages in the red world. If you live in the red world, this is what you get to see. Yeah?
Isn't this also called a frequency distribution?
This is a frequency distribution, yeah. So are you all kind of okay what it is? Let's say it like this, one-liner. For those of you who have never heard it before, don't be intimidated. It's not rocket science. It's not difficult. But I can't go through everything now. But the following one line, I think, is a correct description. This characterizes the red world. This characterizes what's likely to happen in the red world. For example, you're never going to have a sample average out here in the red world. And now comes the punchline. Now we get to observe our data. Say our data was... check our data. Against what I did here was I had like the 1% tail cutoff against this cutoff here. Let's do that. M equal 12 lands here. See, we draw the line. We draw the line here. Here we say beyond here, it's reasonable doubt. This is just very unlikely to happen in the red world. What actually happened is 12. If the 12 happens, question, is it beyond reasonable doubt? No, this is not beyond reasonable doubt. So we would conclude we cannot reject the red hypothesis beyond reasonable doubt. Because we draw the line here to characterize reasonable doubt in the red world. But if the observed data were actually 14, if it's 14, for 14, we would say that's beyond where we draw the line. So 14 is very unlikely beyond reasonable doubt. That doesn't happen in the red world. If 14 does not happen in the red world beyond reasonable doubt, we would conclude that we can allow marketing of that drug. That's what the FDA does. So that's a very well-defined ritual that they do. Did everybody understand the punchline, like the last two lines? If you observe a 12, that's not beyond the line. So you don't call it beyond reasonable doubt. 12 is big. It's large, yeah? 12 is large, but it's not so large that you should never see that, yeah? Yeah? Yeah. Quick answer, yes. Long answer, they get to pick it, but they ask for, like, there's a conversation. They ask for FDA approval. It would be, if they pick too few, that would be really foolish, right? So they ask up front what the FDA will accept eventually, yeah?
But then if they get close to the line, can they continue, or do they have to
Very good point. Imagine the following scenario. You are a drug developer, so say you are working as a manager for whatever is your favorite company, yeah? And you are responsible for that one particular compound. You are responsible for that one particular drug project, yeah? You have spent your last 5 years developing that stuff. Your company has spent billions of dollars to recruit patients, to make that stuff happen. And now in the end, you observe an M equal, say we draw the line at 13.5, and now you observe 13.4. What are you going to do? Cry is legitimate. Anything else? I mean, look for a different job, yeah? But that's really a downer. Wouldn't it be nice if in that case we could go back and we could recruit another 100 patients? That's a very sensible thing to do. Doing such things is called adaptive clinical trial design, where you don't draw the line up front and put it in stone. That's called adaptive clinical trial design. That can be done. In adaptive clinical trial design, so what he's suggesting is, can't we negotiate with the FDA some kind of rule if we get damn close? Can we get some more patients? They're not unreasonable. You can do that. But if you do that, you have to make a good mathematical argument of what constitutes reasonable doubt. And that becomes mathematics. That's probability, yeah?
Is it always 1% for FDA trials, or could it be 2.5%?
I don't think it's always 1%. I really don't know. I would assume it depends on the disease and on the drug. If this is about curing a headache, it's maybe a different story than... Also, if it is a disease like Alzheimer, they probably allow you much more, yeah? Because there is nothing.
Of course. I think that on average, it's something like
less than 0.5% normally, but that's just the average of all medications.
That sounds right, because they surely, 50%, they would end up on the front page of the New York Times, yeah? that is just ludicrous. We would dissolve the FDA, right? But so anywhere 1%, 5%, somewhere around there.
Quick question. Why isn't there an evaluation around just the efficiency of the observed distribution? It seems like this cutoff factor around the reasonable doubt just negates that the observed distribution of the sample versus the observed data.
You mean there's
a lot of efficiency.
There's much more subtlety in the evidence and in the data. Yes. No good answer. Maybe one answer could be: do you agree you need a very well-defined process because people have to be able to rely on it? Yeah. Drug companies are not evil, but they make huge investment decisions. They need to be sure that's what's going to happen. Yeah. So you don't want to have something that's open to interpretation in the end and you have uncertainties, will I do it or not? So there's a big incentive for having something that's well-defined. Maybe that's why this process. But it's changing slowly, yeah? But very slowly. What's happening now is with new technologies, you get more and more data. You record biomarkers. We understand more and more how patients are different or not, yeah? So essentially... that almost gets us to the end already. I hope I told you a little bit what statisticians or mathematicians can do. So I'm a statistician. I should have actually confessed up front. Yeah, I think in statistics we have a PR deficit. Yeah, so many people when you ask them what statistics is, they think of like baseball statistics or the census, and that certainly happens. But there's obviously much more to it. There are wonderful opportunities that many people don't know. Students get out of high school and I guess you know you can become an engineer, a lawyer. You probably know you can become a mathematician, although you might not know what mathematicians really do. Yeah?
Well, I mean, say you're the statistician who's designed this clinical trial, right? Suppose you find out that eventually, you're past, your value is only it's 10%. That's no good. Are you going to get fired over that?
With a reasonable company, hopefully not. If your calculations were wrong, if your probabilities are wrong, you can not only get fired, you can get sued, yeah? Hasn't happened yet, but in principle you can get sued for malpractice if you're the statistician who approved that design, yeah? But let me show you another piece of truth here, if I get it on the board, on the screen. Ooh, what did I do there? And they want to display my laptop, and they want to send it to the right one. This needs engineers, not... to do statistics, the thing to do is you study math in college, you need a good mathematical background, and statistics is something like applied mathematics, yeah? And you actually get paid for it, yeah? No, in the sense, there's a huge demand for statisticians in this country and society. Here in Austin, we have Google. I told you the whole story with patients and adaptive allocation of treatments to patients. Google, at conferences for adaptive clinical trial design, we have Google people show up. They are not concerned about patients, but they are concerned of what's the next ad that they should show you on the screen. Exactly the same problem, yeah? As we get more and more data, Google, Yahoo, they get such massive data. Making sense out of the data, you need good math and probability. I think it's wonderful opportunities. But let me see. I should also tell you the honest truth in life, if I find it. If I find the truth, I'll show you. If I don't find it, I can't show you. Oh, sorry. And I think the truth is eluding me now, but we can at least see the same screen. So this is a little bit, I told you, drug development is about, there's a long rainbow, and at the end of the rainbow, we hope that there's a pot of gold. Sorry. So on that, Downer, thank you for coming, and have a good time. Yeah.